that a few weeks ago that the inventory would not be furnished. There have been other papers that we've sought to get, and while I must say that I've been told I would receive them, the delays have been extraordinary. For example, I asked for all kinds of logs of many principal names in these incidents, and I was promised them back in June. I still haven't got the logs of meetings of the president with such people as Chapin, Colson, Gray, Hunt, Kleindienst, Krogh, LaRue, Liddy, Strawn, or Young. I hope our records are accurate. There are many pending letter requests, and I can't help reading the instruction not to seek subpoenas against that background, even though this instruction, as it's written, refers only to things referring to presidential conversations. And I think I'm entitled to suggest that the thing should be judged against that background. Well, then we come to the immediate incidents, and then I'll be through with this perhaps too long account. You'll remember that the Court of Appeals, after oral argument and before it rendered its decision, suggested that there be an effort to reach a mutually satisfactory accommodation in which the president or his representative and I would agree what parts of the tapes should be made available to the grand jury and what parts should be not. I had conversations chiefly with Fred Bizarre. They were conducted under a pledge of confidentiality. I do not think I ought to violate that pledge. I do think it's proper to say just one thing. I did submit a fairly carefully drafted 6 or 7 page proposed procedure for resolving these questions. I referred to it again within the last week. I have no objection to giving it out, but I don't feel that I am at liberty to do so in view of the promise that I made. I hope I'm not breaking that promise and even referring to it, but it does seem to me to be an essential part of the background. The end of last week, the Attorney General and I were in touch with each other. We had several candid, frank, and very friendly conversations. Indeed, I want to make it plain that at the end of last week and all through this week, the Attorney General has behaved in a way that makes it just as possible for me to say with his complete sincerity, as I said at the Senate Judiciary Committee when we were up at the hearing on his confirmation, that I have admiration, respect, and affection for the Attorney General. And I emphasize that to all of you. The conversations ended in a document headed a proposal. You will see his initials on it, and he knows, in this case, I'm not breaking any promise of confidentiality. He knows that I'm going to give it to you. At least he knows that I might give it to you and that I was free to. It set forth, I'm not going to stop, but you'll all see it. It set forth a plan, somewhat like what was announced yesterday, last night, except that it was in more contingent form, and I think it was meant to leave room for discussion. I wrote him on October 10, a paper called Comments on a Proposal, and we will give you that too. I would emphasize only a few points about it. I did make to him the point I made to you a few moments ago, that I thought the public cannot be fairly asked to confide so difficult and responsible a task to any one man operating in secrecy and consulting only with the White House. Another main point I made was that the object of the proposal was stated too narrowly, that it referred only to Watergate, whereas the things that I have been charged with investigating are a great deal broader, and that I had reason to wish to use the evidence in connection with them, too. I made the points that the standards needed to be stated with more specificity so that there could be no misunderstanding about what the slippery term national defense or national security means. I referred to the problem that an edited version might not be admissible in evidence. I also noted, I guess this is not of great significance, but you might want to observe it. But my 10th point was, I'm puzzled about the practical and political links between our agreeing upon a proposal and the demands of the Irvin Committee. There was no response to me that we're in touch with the Irvin Committee. I learned that when I read the President's statement last night. Let's see, Thursday night, if my memory is correct, I received word that I was to call Marshall Wright at the White House in General Haig's office. Marshall Wright turned out to be Charlie when he came on the phone, and he quickly acknowledged that he was Charlie. But, and he referred to my comments, said that there were four stipulations that were he must make that would be essential to any agreement. And as I understood him, he said, you won't agree to these. The impression I got, and I want to make it clear that it was my impression, maybe the tapes that would verify my impression, or maybe my impression is wrong. But it was my impression that I was being confronted with things that were drawn in such a way that I could not accept them. You will find that there's some differences between his summary of the 4 points and mine. All I can tell you is that mine are right to the best of my recollection. He can speak for himself. I replied that I was in a difficult position. I was sitting on the floor at my brother's house. We were in the middle of dinner. In point of fact, his children were all over the place and filled with excitement, trying to hear what was on the phone and so forth, and that I didn't think that I ought to be put in the position of giving a response under those conditions, but that neither did I wish to imply that there should be any optimism about agreeing to them. I then went on and suggested, why don't you dictate what the 4 points are, and I can look at them tomorrow morning and then give you a reply. And we will give you his letter, which I received, my response, and then one final letter, which suggested that I had misunderstood the scope for some of the things he said. That came at 23 minutes past 5 yesterday. My letter was delivered about 10 o'clock. There was ample time to explain if I had misunderstood anything of critical importance.
And that was the former Special Watergate Prosecutor Archibald Cox, who once was the Solicitor General of the United States and who was fired tonight by the Solicitor General of the United States, who has been named Acting Attorney General. In the questions that followed that session with reporters, Cox said that he might do two things, but he wasn't sure which one. He might ask the courts for a contempt citation in the matter of the president's preferred compromise on the tapes, or that he might ask the courts for a clarification. We don't know what the clarification means. We'll be covering more of this story, including what William Ruckelshaus, who was also fired tonight as Deputy Attorney General, has to say, and we'll get the views of Senator Howard Baker, the Vice Chairman of the Senate Watergate Committee. We'll do that after this.
This is the NBC Television Network.
Two of the men involved in today's dramatic events in Washington have held a number of jobs recently, this year and last year, in the Nixon administration. Elliot Richardson was Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, Secretary of Defense, and Attorney General. It is said of him that someone wanted him for a speaking engagement. They say they asked the Secretary of HEW, they got an acceptance from the Secretary of Defense, and then they got a cancellation from the Attorney General, all the same man. William Ruckelshaus has been head of the Environmental Protection Agency, and then in the chaos of Watergate, he was named head of the FBI when L. Patrick Gray left the stage. And then when Clarence Kelly was named the permanent head of the FBI, William Ruckelshaus was made Deputy Attorney General. And today, because he wouldn't fire Archibald Cox, he himself was fired by the president. Our correspondent, Claire Crawford, talked with William Ruckelshaus today, and he reflected upon and recounted the events of the day.
Well, I think it's fairly well known now that the president decided after Mr. Cox's press conference that he should be discharged. And he asked the Attorney General to do that, and the Attorney General refused. And he then asked me to do that. Not the president, Mr. Haig, asked me to do that. And I did not believe that in conscience I could do that, and I suggested that they go to the next in line in the Justice Department, Mr. Bork.
Why didn't you feel in conscience you could do that?
Well, because there was an agreement entered into between the Attorney General and the Special Prosecutor when the Special Prosecutor was appointed and the Attorney General was confirmed, which indicated that he was to have complete independence and only to be discharged if there were gross improprieties. And I did not believe that, while I felt the President's suggestion of using Senator Stennis as the listener of the tapes was a reasonable one, I didn't believe that there were any gross improprieties in the Special Prosecutor refusing that.
How did you hear that you were fired?
Well, I sent a letter of resignation over the White House after I talked to General Haig, and I heard it on the radio that I was fired.
Were you surprised?
No, I wasn't surprised. I was sure that I was going to, because I had not complied with a direct order through General Haig from the President, and I think he was entirely within his rights and justified in firing me because of that.
What do you think this means for the country?
Well, I don't know. It's I'm probably the worst person to ask in many ways. I think that it's unfortunate that we were not able to have a special prosecutor convince the people that everything was right with the world after his investigation and trials and prosecutions were over. And now people will probably continue to have doubts. I would hope that we could find some way to convince the American people that this matter and all the matters relating to Watergate was cleared up once and for all. Well, that's kind of sad. You know, I really have a deep affection for the Justice Department, and I hope to God that the morale that I think was rising again in the Justice Department is not in any way unduly hurt by this. And I hope that the President can find an Attorney General. I don't think he'll find one as good as Elliot Richardson, because I don't think there are many of those around, but I hope he finds a good one, and that he can restore the morale of that extraordinarily important department in this country.
What did you and Mr. Richardson talk about before you resigned?
Well, we talked about ways of encouraging the president to look at this in a different perspective and to see if we couldn't solve this problem in some other way. And then when it was clear that we couldn't, both of us recognized that we really had no alternative.
Your wife works at the White House as an advisor to presidential advisor, Mrs. Armstrong. Has she decided whether or not she's going to quit?
No, she hasn't decided that yet.
You talked about it yet?
Well, just fleetingly. We've been talking about other things tonight.
What is your mood, sir?
Oh, my mood. I suppose, like anyone who's been in government and feels very strongly about the need to have a strong government and society, I'm disappointed in leaving in this fashion. But again, I have believed from the beginning of the time I've ever served in government that one of the options you must always keep open to you in government is the option to resign. If you feel that what you're asked to do is simply something that your conscience tells you you can't do.
We should remember and keep in mind that what has brought on this grave constitutional crisis is the president's offer of a compromise on his 9 secret White House tapes requested by the special Watergate prosecutor, plus one other requested by the committee, 10 in all. The arrangement the president offered was to let Senator John Stennis listen to the tapes, authenticate them, and then the president would send out a transcript of what he felt was relevant information about Watergate on those tapes. I'd like to ask Carl Stern, who's in our studios in Washington, if I have described that accurately and if that is what he has learned from the White House.
Yes, you have, John, and there's something about it which tells us that the tiff is not yet over between the White House and the Ervin Committee. Now, last night, the president said that Senators Baker and Ervin of the Watergate Committee had accepted this procedure for verified summaries. Today, Senator Ervin said that was not true, that what they had agreed to receive was verbatim transcripts. Senator Ervin said he had discussed this on the telephone today with Mr. Bizzard in the White House and that was all in agreement. Now, tonight, when I was leaving the White House just 3 hours ago, I talked with a senior official there, and he said Senator Ervin is wrong again, that they have not promised the Watergate Committee a verbatim transcript. So we seem to be back where we started.
Carl, we have placed a telephone call to Senator Howard Baker, the vice chairman of the committee, and I hope if this works that he'll be able to tell us about that now. Senator Baker, are you there in Tennessee?
Yeah, Mr. Chancellor, I'm right here.
Well, I'm sorry to bother you this late at night, Senator, but we would like, in addition to getting your general reaction to the events of the day, we'd like you to see if you could clear up for us what the arrangement actually is, as you understand it, with Senator Stennis. Is he going to listen to all the tapes, or is he going to listen only to the parts that relate to Watergate?
No, it's my clear understanding that John Stennis will listen to all of the tapes. It was my understanding on yesterday when Senator Ervin and I met with the senior staff at the White House and later with the president that the White House would make available two pieces of information. First, the tapes themselves in their original form for John Stennis, together with a detailed summary, which was characterized to us as being full, complete, and accurate, that Senator Stennis then would listen to the tapes and re-listen to the tapes as necessary to verify that the summary was full, complete, and accurate. Now, to me, at that time, I assumed that to mean that the summary would include a very exact transcription of the language of the conversation and the dialogue that was relevant to the items of inquiry that the committee wanted. Now, today, I understand there was some misunderstanding or some incomplete understanding on whether we would receive verbatim transcripts of the tape on those relevant portions. I've today once again talked to the White House, and I'm convinced that
And you've said, Senator, that you would be satisfied with this. You and Senator Ervin would go along with this as an acceptable compromise.
I think compromise isn't quite the right word. Senator Ervin and I indicated that we'd be glad to have that information, that we would welcome it. After all, that's what we were trying to get in our litigation. But it's not a compromise in the sense that we gave up something in return. The committee gave up nothing. We made no promise to discontinue our lawsuit. We made no commitment to alter our course of action, our investigation, or our techniques. There are no commitments made to the White House as a quid pro quo for these tapes. So I suppose compromise in the peacemaking sense is an accurate description, but compromise in the sense of give and take certainly was not part of our conversation yesterday.
Senator, you're a lawyer. The president for quite a long time was insistent and went into court and argued that he didn't have to give this material to the committee. Why now has he given the material, or about to give the material to the committee, using this route?
I'm not really sure. I'm afraid that the very best I could do would be to surmise why. I think that the tape issue has been so politicized and has become such a symbolic controversy that it's entirely possible that the president wants to lower the tensions involved on this particular issue. That may or may not be one of the reasons. I indicated yesterday at the White House that I was glad that we found a way, apparently, to get the information without protracted litigation, and I frankly would have hoped that this would have happened 3 months ago or 4 months ago, but I don't know that I can tell you why the president has chosen this way now. All I can say is that I'm happy that he has, and I hope nothing comes up to mess up the arrangement, because the committee very badly needs that information from those tapes, which contain unique information, and we need it in its original form, that is, in careful, exact language as recorded electronically on those tapes.
Two quick questions, Senator. I know it's late, but if you indulge me, one, I'd like to know, are you going to continue, or will the committee continue court action for the tapes?
The committee hadn't met to determine that yet. I think a lot will depend on how we receive these transcripts or summaries, as the case may be, and how we're convinced that they are a full and fair disclosure of all of the relevant data. I suppose that if we're convinced that we have all of the information, that we would not pursue the tapes. On the other hand, we may decide that in an abundance of precaution, we should pursue the litigation and take it through the Supreme Court. But that's a decision we've yet to make. I've received information that we can expect something in possibly 2 weeks. I think the time element depends on how fast John Stennis can listen to these things and hear them over and over to verify their accuracy. But it may be we can't make a decision on whether we proceed with the lawsuit until after we receive the documents. We have almost 30 days under the rules of the court to decide that issue, so we'll wait and see.
Senator, I have to ask you this question, not because we disbelieve the president, but because a number of people are asking the question today, and I don't know if you can give any better answer than I can, but how can Senator Stennis, listening to the tapes in the White House, determine if those tapes have been doctored in any way? I'm embarrassed to bring it up, but it's on the minds of a lot of people.
I think it's a valid question, and it's a question that I think we've taken account of in our conversations with the White House. John Stennis has the full authority not only to verify the summary or transcript as to its apparent accuracy in terms of his hearing the tapes and comparing the documents, but it's implicit in the language, full and complete and accurate disclosure, which was the language we used yesterday. It's implicit in that Senator Stennis has the authority as well to try to verify and validate the integrity of the tapes. I don't suggest that we will have to do that, but I think one can clearly infer from that language that Senator Stennis has that authority, and he may or may not choose to proceed further with it.
Senator, could a reporter infer from what you've said that Senator Stennis might engage some technicians or scientists if he had some suspicion?
A reporter could infer that. I don't suggest that, and I don't
thank you for being with us tonight, and we'll be seeing you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Senator Howard Baker, the vice chairman of the Watergate Committee, giving us more details than we've had before on the arrangement that the White House is making with Senator Stennis, who will authenticate those tapes. I would like now to ask Carl Stern, who's in our studio in Washington, the question that I guess is on everybody's mind at this moment, Carl, what next?
John, I have to divide that in two parts. On the prosecution side, I would say the prosecution is in shambles. The case now goes back to the Justice Department. It'll be interesting to see what Henry Peterson can do with it. He had a chance once. He said that they were 90% along the line. Interestingly enough, Mr. Peterson may end up having to resign because he may feel, being a good lawyer, that if he's not to simply have to dismiss all the possible Watergate cases, that he's going to have to produce the tapes in court because of certain rights that the defendants, ultimate defendants, may have. So what will Mr. Peterson do? An interesting question. On the other side of the ledger, what will the courts do? I've talked with a number of experts. No two of them agree. My own estimate based on what they said was this, that it is possible that Chief Judge John Sirica in the trial court, since he is no shrinking violet, may take it upon himself to make an effort to get compliance with the Court of Appeals decision and to put aside the compromise that the president is offering. Nonetheless, it is the feeling that when that case gets to the Court of Appeals, that the Court of Appeals, being a mature body, knowing the realities, that you cannot, in fact, cite a president of the United States for contempt and punish him, the feeling is that the Court of Appeals will go along with the compromise that the president offered. So in that sense, the president would win.
Carl, is the president technically tonight in violation of the law?
No, I would say not. The Court of Appeals has given its judgment as to what the president's duties are. And it would now be up to the appropriate parties to go into court and seek to enforce the rights which they've won. That would have been Prosecutor Cox. He's now been removed. Even though you win something in court, you can always go back in and seek modifications, make a settlement even after judgment and so on. So I would not say in the strict legal sense that the president has violated the law, no.
Let me ask you another question, Carl. When all of this began some time ago, the Deputy White House Press Secretary came out one day and said that the president would obey a definitive order of the Supreme Court. And we all believed then that the White House intended to take it to the Supreme Court. Suddenly, we've found that it's taken quite another turn, Carl, that it almost as though he didn't want to go to the Supreme Court. What can you tell us about that?
I discussed that precise issue with one of the president's legal advisors tonight, and what he told me was this, that the president did not want to take the chance. That's not a quote, that's a paraphrase, but did not want to take the chance of a Supreme Court decision, something which would bind his hands forever. That the president felt he had to do something at this point, and the president did.
Well, could it possibly have been the fact that Melvin Laird said that in his position as a White House advisor, he told the president that if the president defied a Supreme Court order, he would be impeached or moved for impeachment? I think that may have had something to do with it, Carl, standing as we do on the outside. I'd like to go on and ask David Brinkley what he thinks about the public and the congressional reaction to all of these events. David?
Well, it's sheer guesswork, of course, John, at this point. I think, however, that aside from the very complex legal aspects, Mr. Nixon's critics in Congress and perhaps a number of the American people will insist, nevertheless, on seeing it in very simple terms. And in the simplest terms, it is that an investigator appointed to investigate scandals was fired because he insisted on investigating scandals. And put that way, the reaction in Congress, and I suspect among many of the American people, will be very critical.
Thank you, David. Well, just to bring you up to date on where we stand now, the crisis of the president's 9 or 10 disputed secret White House tapes has brought about a constitutional situation that is without precedent in the history of this republic. The president has...